So this week's parasha is Vayishlach Tavshin Ayin Tet. So a little bit of a preamble. When we get to Yaakov's life, there is one scene that I think is incredibly important to put everything else within that particular context. And that scene is when Yaakov is lying on the ground and he sees a ladder with its feet on the ground and its head up in the clouds. That means that there's going to be something about Yaakov, which in a sense is going to be a combination of these two very different things, heaven and earth. There's going to be a sense of Yaakov, which is going to be a synthesis between these different things. There's going to be resolution between different things. The Kabbalists described Yaakov as being Tiferet. And Tiferet is, if we'll use the Hegelian dialectic, we have, on the one hand, Avraham is Chesed, which is the thesis, and then you have Yitzchak, which is Gvura, Din, which is the antithesis, and then you have Yaakov as the synthesis, and that's Tiferet. Tiferet is beauty. Those of you who are somewhat familiar with the Kabbalistic chart, as it were, so then you have, I'll try to do this inverse so this works, you have your right side, which is my left, your right side and your left side, and then Yaakov in the center. Yaakov becomes part of the center issue, and that's this synthesis. Our parsha begins with Yaakov in a great deal of trouble. The trouble is because his past has caught up with him. That's as simple as we can put it. Sometimes when you run away from things, it doesn't work as a long-term strategy, because sometimes the things that you run away from end up catching up with you. In this particular case, Yaakov, we know, a long time ago ran away from his brother, and he ran away from Israel. And now his brother's coming towards him, and he's coming towards his brother. And at the end of the day, we're going to have a resolution over here. We're actually going to have a number of resolutions. But I do want to remind us about how the Parsha ends. The Parsha ends talking about kings, leaders, powerful people in Esav, which means even though we may think or we may have thought as we look at that, oh, you know, we were okay. But the end of the Parsha is this description of power of Esav. Long before there was a king in Israel, that's an interesting verse. Long before there's a king in Israel, there's kings and powers and organization, things taking place within this Esav world. And, you know, as any good drama, this should be something that should terribly frighten us, because now we're realizing that the enemy is actually stockpiling weapons and they are, again, increasing in power, while we're just sort of ignoring all of this and going on and leading our lives. So let's keep in mind that we may or may not have a happy ending to this, but I will say something else, and we may not have realized it. The question of our kingship, right, long before there's a king in Israel, the question of our kingship is going to be significant, although, again, we may not see it here, it may not appear, but there are going to be a lot of things which are beneath the surface. Okay, introduction number two. Many years ago, I gave a shiur, and the shiur somehow got a title, and I wrote an essay. I think in those days I used to somehow do them both in 1 week. I would write long essays, and I would give the shiur, and it would be the same topic. I was obviously much younger and trying to avoid parenting my children or something, but I don't know how I had the time to do such things. And the name of that particular essay was Echoes of Eden. Later on, some of you may have recognized that I then had one book and then five books, which ended up being called Echoes of Eden. But there was one article, there was one essay, one shiur, which was called Echoes of Eden. And I came to the realization fairly late in preparing for this shiur, which means this morning, that this may very well be the continuation of that particular shiur. And that's enough of introductions. The other thing about Yaakov's life is we're never sure with Yaakov. When we see the word malach or malachim, we're never sure, are we dealing with something on the ground or something in the clouds? I mean, that's the problem. And this week's parasha begins. Last week's parasha ends with malchei Elohim. This week's parasha begins, v'yishlach Yaakov malachim. Yaakov sent malachim. So are these malachim, malachei Elohim? I mean, does Yaakov now have God's angels working for him? I mean, is he subcontracting, or are these just messengers. So which is this? And I'll say this again, we never know. We have malachim, which we may think are people, and then we have a person later on who we may think is a malach, which should hopefully confuse us completely. But once again, Yaakov is on this continuum someplace between heaven and earth, and that's exactly what our challenge is. Vayishlach Yaakov malachim, and Yaakov sends malachim to Esav. Now, Yaakov has a problem. His problem is that Esav has sworn that he was going to kill him. I like the other phrases or terms that are used here. Vayishlach Yaakov malachim lafanav el Esav achiv, he sends to Esav his brother, Arzeh Seir, Sedei Edom. So we have Seir, we have Edom. These are all things or names, or concepts which are associated with Esav. So we have a real powerful Esav verse over here, and Yaakov is sending malachim. So maybe you need something which is powerful, or maybe even something which has some dust of divine on it in order to be able to survive. And Yaakov commands then, and he says, "Vayitzav otam lemor kol tamrim la adoni la Esav." And right away we hear something which may upset some of you, but it's very practical. And what is that? That Yaakov is immediately going into a subservient sense. Subservience. Adoni Esav, my master Esav. Which means when you have two brothers, there should theoretically be equality. When you have two brothers, and one of them is saying to the other one, or about the other one, you are my master. So we understand as a strategy why Yaakov will do this. But as I said, a lot of Yaakov's strategy in this week's parasha may disappoint us. Chazal never really forgive Yaakov for bowing down to Esav. Because, of course, and you know we've said this so many times, we're never sure when we read Yaakov and Esav, are we talking about Yaakov and Esav? Are we talking about Israel, the Jewish people, and are we talking about Rome? Are we talking about the Jewish people and Christianity? Who exactly is within this conversation is never really clear, especially when the rabbis are dealing with this later on in time. So if we're dealing with Rome, we're dealing with Christianity, and Judaism is bowing down to Christianity, that's something which is far more painful than Yaakov making a strategic decision right now that maybe this is a good idea to get out of this particular battle, or this, you know, lose this battle as it were, but win the war. So, or we need to also understand what survival is. In when Menachem Begin traveled to America in order to have his arm twisted at the King David negotiations, he stopped in New York beforehand and he met with three different rabbis. And this is not like a joke. He met with three different rabbis independently, and all three rabbis told him the exact same thing. One of them was Rav Moshe Feinstein, one of them was Lubavitcher Rebbe, and the third one was Rabbi Soloveitchik. And they all told him the same thing, that there's a Yerushalmi that says every time that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who was the Nasi, the president, the leader of the Jewish people, anytime he would go and meet with the Roman dignitaries, he would always read over Parsha Vayishlach before he went. This is Jewish strategy, is reading Yaakov's strategy. So what is Yaakov's strategy? So you know it from Rashi. Rashi tells us, or you can read the words, that he prepares for battle, and I want to come back to that in a moment. He prepares for battle. He prepares by praying, and he does indeed pray. And he prepares by trying to bribe the other side, which may work. It's the battle which perturbs me, because he is not preparing for battle to win the war. What does he do? He divides into two different camps. And what's his preparation for battle? Well, if they wipe out one camp, then at least the other one will survive. Which means that the strategy that he's using over here is not the strategy to win a war. This is the kind of strategy, I mean, I hate to say it, this is the kind of strategy that was used during the Holocaust. And when the enemy is trying to eradicate you, when the enemy's objective is genocide, so then survival is victory. For Yaakov, survival is victory. So therefore, if we survive, some of us survive, one of us survives, so then we won because we survived. So that's a very funny battle. It's just survival. It's not any more than that. And that's what Yaakov's doing over here. And I'm going to say it again. That's what comes out as being, you know, a little disturbing to us, because when perhaps we look today at military situations and we look at them very, very differently. And I am always somewhat amused when I, you know, read, especially the last couple of weeks, you know, I don't know if anybody noticed, like over like 36 hours or so we had a war, and reading all kinds of suggestions by people who have no understanding of anything having to do with the military, or we should have done this and we could have done this and so on, without realizing, well, what's the end game and what happens if you achieve that end game and so on and so forth. And I'm not going to say anything more about it. But it's not always as simple as we would like. And this is a complex situation. So Yaakov's strategy over here, we hear it already before he starts. Sela Adoni Esav. In the next verse, Vav. Vayihi lishor v'chamor tzon ve'eved shvicha v'eshlachad lahagid la'adoni l'mtzochei b'neinecha. So again, he calls him my master. But there's a problem. The problem is in Pasuk Zayin. V'yishvu hamalachim el Yaakov le'mor banu alachicha el Esav. We've come to your brother, to Esav. V'gam alech l'kratcha. And what a coincidence. He's coming to see you as well. V'arba ma'ot ish imo. And he has 400 men with him. Which means that Esav has decided, I don't want any of you to be confused, because I know you people. Some of you are thinking, wow, that's great, a marching band. What a wonderful thing. He's going to make a party. He's got the caterers over here. He's got the food. He's got the caterers. And this is going to be a wonderful celebration. Brothers reunited. Wow. And I think that some of you may realize that that's not what we're talking about. What's taking place over here instead is that Esav has found 400 mercenaries. And the mercenaries are over here for one purpose, and that purpose is eradication, genocide, to kill the entire Yaakov family. And as far as Esav is concerned, I've waited a long time for my vengeance, and now I will get my, not just pound of flesh, now I will get my revenge. This is very, very clear, although we do have to notice something, because sometimes obvious things are not so obvious to us, and that's why you still need me. One thing is, Esav certainly knew exactly where Yaakov was, which means there wasn't a secret over here. There were two different missions he was sent on. His mother said, run away because he wants to kill you. His father said, oh, go find a wife and go to your mother's brother and go to the family over there. So this wasn't a secret. You don't think that Esav could have said to his father, by the way, I haven't seen Yaakov around recently, which means it's very obvious to me that he knew exactly where he was. So if he knew exactly where he was, why does he wait so long? Why is he waiting for all of these years to go and to kill him? I mean, the Esav that we love and fear is somebody who should go get revenge. Why wait till now? Now, that is probably a stronger question than you realize. It also tells us part of the answer. The other question that I want to raise, which also should be completely obvious, although I couldn't find anybody to ask, who asked this question, and that is, why does Esav pick 400 people? Now, you're going to say, well, if you would have picked 399, you would have asked the same question. And you're right, I would have. But if we get to put Esav on the couch and to say, listen, Esav, why don't you tell me something? When you chose the number 400, that's just a very interesting number. Was there anything either conscious or subconscious that you chose this particular number? And I'm not exactly sure what Esav would necessarily have said, although I will point out that the number 400 comes up twice in previous narratives. But hold up one second. I, before we get there, let me just say what I think is obvious. And that is that the whole time that Yaakov is outside of the land of Israel, Esav doesn't care. It's only when Yaakov comes back to the land of Israel, that's suddenly when Esav wakes up and remembers, hold it a second, you know, all the terrible things that you did to me. Let me put it like this. I mentioned Rabbi Soloveitchik before. I'll tell you something that he once said that I thought was absolutely profound. Not to say there weren't a lot of other profound things that he said, but this I thought was absolutely profound. He may have quoted somebody this, but I've never found who may have said this first. I thought he said the Kuzari, but I couldn't find any reference to it there. He said that very often anti-Semites have a better idea of holiness than Jews do. He goes, if you see something which upsets anti-Semites, then you should know they have radar. They have radar for holiness. If anti-Semites today are upset about Shechita, now it could be that there are a lot of Jews who don't care about Shechita anymore, but it still upsets them, so now you know that there's something very holy about it. If circumcision bothers them, so now you know that there's something very holy about it. If when Jews have sovereignty in the land of Israel, it completely drives them crazy, so now you know that there's an incredible amount of holiness which goes on here. And I don't care if the government is as religious as you want, not religious. The fact that this upsets anti-Semites so much tells you about the profound holiness of the fact that we have sovereignty in this land. That starts here with Esav. Yaakov can be with love and all this time. Yeah, I have a brother. I hate my brother. I'd kill my brother if I got my hands on him. Right? He can go on and on like this. But he doesn't act on it until Yaakov comes back. If Yaakov's going to come back to Israel, then Esav suddenly goes crazy. And if you think that this is just, oh, that's a coincidence, it's not. And I'll come back to the 400 men in a second. What happens when Am Yisrael is in Egypt for all the years? We don't hear a word from Amalek. But as soon as they leave Egypt and they're on the way to Israel, suddenly Amalek wakes up. Hold it. There are these people over here that my grandfather was sworn against, and we have to go wipe them out. Amalek wakes up only when the Jews are about to go back to Israel. The whole Purim story with Haman, when the 70 years were up of exile and it was time for them to go back, and suddenly Haman wakes up. Hold it. There are these people that I hate. It's this start of the Jews to come back to Israel, which awakens with anti-Semites. And again, I will not be the first or the only who will say that the new anti-Semitism is anti-Zionism and so on. And I hope that you... I'm thinking of getting an Airbnb something just so that I can cancel it this week. There's no room over here for confusion. There, and this doesn't mean that everything that Jews do or everything the state of Israel does is wonderful and perfect and so on. But I'll say it again. There's a certain element of Jewish sovereignty that gets magnified. The fact that you can have as many UN declarations about Israel and human rights and so on. So we really are guilty of 10,000 times, I think that's the statistics, maybe it's more even, 10,000 times more of human rights violations than any other nation on this earth. Is that the reality? No. There's something about the fact that we're here which completely, completely drives anti-Semites crazy, and it's Esav, and it's Amalek, and it's Haman from Amalek, and I can go, and we can go on and on and on. The one who actually made this point about when Amalek gets upset, or Esav gets upset, is found in the Rav Tzedek HaKohen from Lin in a book called Yisrael Kedoshim, which I think is quite appropriate, because that's exactly the point. Anti-Semites have radar for Kedusha. If something upsets them, now we know that that's important. Esav is full of contradictions. Esav in this week's parasha ends up upsetting us because he doesn't act like Esav. At the end of the day, he ends up hugging and kissing and making up with him. What kind of Esav is this? So I figured it's like this, but you have to save this for Purim, that the Gemara says, I think it's Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says, halacha b'yadua hi she'esav sones es Yaakov. It's a halacha that Esav hates Yaakov. So once Esav found out it's a halacha, so then he had to break that. So that's why he makes up with him. So, where did we get the number, or why is the number 400? So as I said, it comes up twice in the narrative, in source number 3. It's during the Brit Bein Abtarim, and that's when Avraham was told that your descendants will be in a land which is not theirs. There will be no sovereignty of Jews for 400 years. Which is, by the way, you need to read that verse. V'yom alav yodea tida kigirya zaracha be'eretz lo lahem. They won't have sovereignty. It's not that the slavery was 400 years. It will take 400 years until the land will be theirs. Va'avadum v'inu'otam, and during this time, they will be enslaved and tortured, arba'mot shana. The arba'mot shana is after the etnachta, which means the arba'mot shana goes back on the first part of the verse. During this 400 years, they will experience a lack of sovereignty, and they will experience slavery, but it didn't say the slavery is going to be the entire 400 years. And that's, by the way, pshat, in how you read this verse. But the number 400 is the number 400 having to do with, at the end of 400 years, then we will own this land. So I find that interesting. The other thing which is interesting is that the number 400 was used in source number 4 as the amount paid by Avraham for the first acquisition of the land of Israel, which means the number 400 in both of these instances, and I don't believe there's a third instance, in both of these instances, the number 400 is centered around ownership of the land of Israel. And then I wonder what Esav is doing with those 400 soldiers. So is this a conscious decision, a subconscious decision? Does Esav not know about this? I don't know. And I'll tell you the truth. I'll have a hard time using the word pshat right now, but it doesn't make a difference because I still think that this is correct. I don't think that this is coincidental. It could have said with a whole band of men, a whole group of men, soldiers, didn't have to give. The number 400 I find to be significant, and there is other significance to this as well. If we go back now to source number 2, in source number 2, I want to finish up source number 1, because there's a couple of other things that happen over here. Sorry, in source number 1. Yaakov sends these gifts again. The term you know already that I like to do this, I like to bold things that you can see them. So, and you don't have to read anything else. Just read the bolded words. Mincha la'avdecha, mincha la'aduni, mincha avdecha, ha-mincha, and so on, which means there's words that come up again and again in the narrative, and that the gift that he's going to give, the present that he's going to give. He's going to be sending over this mincha, this gift, this so on. So I also find it interesting that of all the words to use, that the word used in this context is mincha. Okay? But that's minchi shlucha. That's what's used over here. And the other thing that you keep noticing, he keeps referring to Esav as Adoni, as the master, and himself as Avdecha, as the one who's subservient. So therefore, this is in direct distinction to the bracha that he stole, where it talks about Yaakov having subservience. So Yaakov over here is disassociating himself, at least in his words, from the blessing which he had taken. Towards the very end of that section, Pasuk Kaf Hei of Source 1, we're told, and this is the famous scene, Vayivater Yaakov Levado, and Yaakov remained by himself. Now that itself may indicate some type of, that Yaakov himself doesn't know what to do. You know, he's divided into two camps, so which camp does he join? So he loves Rachel, but on the other hand, maybe the fact that he's there is going to bring more, a stronger attack. Maybe the other one is the one who's going to survive. And Yaakov's ambivalence, I think, is the word. Yaakov doesn't really know what to do, and Yaakov ends up being all the way by himself. The beautiful rabbinic teaching, which somehow has got to be connected to Hanukkah, is that he goes looking for pachim ktanim. He goes looking for these little flasks, and maybe we'll be able to work that in as well, especially if those flasks had oil in them, which maybe we'll be able to find. So, Vayivata Yaakov Levado, Yaakov's all by himself, Vayavik Ishimo Adelot HaShachar, and a man wrestles with him until the break of day. So, any of you who never bought my first book, Explorations, the price of the book is worth it for my essay on Vayishlach. I'm just saying, that's my own personal opinion. But don't buy it now. I haven't heard from the publisher in years. They keep selling it, and then they claim they went bankrupt, but they keep selling it. So I don't know why they're bankrupt anymore, because they keep selling my book. But I'm going to believe Ned to come out with a new edition of it, and actually added to this week's parsha. I keep adding every week, but I added to this week's parsha as recently as last night. And one of the things that I put forward there, and I'll just mention that I wrote this in 1996, and I don't know when I first gave the shiur on this, but I wrote this in 1996, and at that point, I don't think anyone else said this. Today, everybody says it, so I probably stole it from everybody else somehow by looking in the future. But what I had suggested at that point is that the way this is described is it's if Yaakov really is by himself, and therefore there's some kind of wrestling with himself which is taking place. And to support that, it says Vayivater Yaakov Levado Vayivek Ishimo. But the problem is, it's an ish. So who's this ish? So what I suggested is that when Yaakov makes a lot of money, how does it describe him? Vayifrotza ish ma'od ma'od Vayilotzon and so on and gemalim. That Yaakov had all kinds of money, but then he calls him the ish. So then the struggle that would be taking place is the struggle between Yaakov. Who's Yaakov? Yaakov is an ish tam yoshev o'alim. He's a simple person, a spiritual person, somebody who sits in tents. And what does he become? He becomes a very wealthy man. And therefore, Yaakov goes through this struggle. The resolution of the struggle is, well, first of all, the blessing has to be confirmed. I'm not going to let you go till you give me the blessing. And he goes, what's your name? Your name is Yaakov. No, it's not Yaakov. Most muggers don't rename you, right? They may call you things, but most muggers don't give you a new name. And he goes, no, that's not your name. You're Yisrael. Which means Yaakov just went through a metamorphosis. But it's interesting because this metamorphosis is not one where his previous name is never used. See, that's again with Yaakov. Yaakov always becomes this resolution, this dialectic, but over here this dialectic seems to be, in a certain sense, an unresolved dialectic, because he is Yaakov, yet he is Yisrael, but we need to understand what both names are and really what the meaning over here is. So give me a second, I'll come back to that. At the very end of this, Yaakov's thigh is hurt. Yaakov's thigh is hurt. That is very important, extremely important. And at the end, we're told, okay, Yaakov hurt his thigh, so we can't eat that part of the animal till this day. And every time I read this, I say the exact same thing, that Baruch Hashem, he didn't break a rib, or we'd all be in trouble right now. And it was only a leg, and it's not that you can't eat it, unless you live in certain countries that think you can't eat it. It's just it's painstaking, slow work to take the Gid HaNasha out of the animal. And the metaphor over here is one of that you need to slow down. Later on, when Yaakov meets up with Esav, and I think, again, I'll just say this in 1 minute, so now you can save money, you don't have to buy that book. I think that Yaakov is struggling with himself, because Yaakov no longer knows, is he Yaakov or is he Esav? There's so much more Esav. Meaning, the price that he paid ultimately for stealing the brachas, he had to run away, and he has to live the life of Esav, which is so much deeper than we realize, including marrying Leah. He lives the life of Esav. He lives two lives, which is, by the way, ultimately why he needs two different names. He leads two different lives. He leads the life of Yaakov, and he leads the life of Esav. But the life of Esav is an unholy life, and he somehow needs now to take the life of Esav and to somehow to elevate it. And Yaakov knows how to do this. Why do I say he knows how to do this? Because Yaakov knows the secret of starting on the ground and climbing up into the ladder and coming back to the ground. The idea of the Gid Hanasha over here is to be involved in the physical world, elevating the physical world, but still being involved in the physical world. Yaakov, the name itself, has to do with the struggle that took place. Now that's why we need to pause right here again. Yaakov and Esav struggled on a previous occasion. They struggled in utero. And in utero, at the very end of this struggle, you have Yaakov grabbing at Esav's heel, and Yaakov's name is connected to that heel, and Yaakov's definition is in relationship to Esav. Part of what happens with this new name, in this new name, he's no longer related to Esav. In the new name, Yisrael, he struggles with the divine. He struggles with God. He struggles with holiness, which means, who is Yaakov? Is he the one who struggles with Esav? Is he the one that struggles with things which are holy? And that's why I'm saying there's two different identities, but he keeps both identities because neither one is really resolved, and they both are going to be parts of who he is. The Gid Hanasha, therefore, is the metaphor which is incredible. That's part of the story. The very end of the story is that Yaakov then goes to Sukkot. And what is Sukkot? Sukkot is also this beautiful dialectic. On the one hand, we take the Arba Min, and we take fruit, and we pray for rain. Rain in Hebrew is Geshem. We pray for Gashmiut. We pray for physicality. We pray for our bank accounts. And at the exact same time that we're doing this, we leave our homes, we go into a temporary abode with God's glory hanging on top of the Shechina, sitting on top of the Sukkah, and saying, listen, this whole world is not all that important anyway. That dialectic is Yaakov. That's Tiferet. But within the Tiferet, there's a combination of the Chesed and the Din, which means that this middle road of Yaakov is the combination of this world and the other world. It's the combination of the physicality and the spirituality. It's being on the ground and having your head in heaven. It's going up to heaven and bringing things down. Now, let's get back to our... Excuse me? It is beautiful. Maybe you should buy the book. One second, Esther. Now, if we go back then, there's something else that we can't miss. We can't miss this. And that is that in this first fight, Yaakov is grabbing at Esav's leg. In the second fight, this mysterious adversary is grabbing and wounding Yaakov's leg. So just in case you think this is a total coincidence and one thing has nothing to do with the other, these are two completely random occurrences. Probably the most important commentary on that lonely night where Yaakov is attacked along the way, the most important commentary, I'll apologize to Rashi and to the Ramban and to the Sforno and to all kinds, somebody who asks questions of people and puts it in the newspaper, asked me to answer a question. Who is your go-to commentary? So this will be in the newspaper at some point. But I really don't have a go-to commentary because I read all the commentaries. Actually, the best things that I actually read is just the Chumash. My first stage is always reading the Chumash without anything. And the second stage is to read the Chumash with Unkelus. And the third stage is to look at all the other commentaries, especially when I'm looking for particular things. But the best commentary in this verse is in source number 6. Who wrote this commentary? A man named Hoshea. Hoshea, in case you don't know him, was a prophet. Bebeten akav et achiv. What does that mean? In utero, akav et achiv. Now, that's real interesting. Akav is it that he passed by him? Is that he grabbed his ankle? It's a real interesting turn of phrase. Bebeten akav et achiv, in case you're not sure who he's talking about. Uva ono, when he had his full strength, sarah et Elohim. He struggled with something which was of great might, either holy use or non-holy use, either the Almighty or something which is very powerful. Vayasar el malach, vayuchal. He wrestled or struggled with the malach, and he was victorious. Bacha v'tchanen lo. And I believe that that's referring to the angel. The angel cried and begged him, you know, let me go. So what we have over here is, wow, that's an unbelievable commentary on this, because what did it just now do? It just brought together those two episodes. So it's so interesting that when Yaakov actually meets up with Esav, he escapes unscathed unless you're really troubled by this bowing down. On the other hand, when Yaakov meets with what we call Saroshel Esav, what's a Saroshel Esav? So that we need a little bit of an explanation. Saroshel Esav is a major character in Jewish mysticism, in Midrashim as well. He has a name. Samael is what he's called. That's Saroshel Esav, the power of Esav. Yaakov, I believe, when I said that he struggles with himself because he has become so much Esav-like, so it's as if the power of Esav has now run some kind of a hostile takeover of Yaakov. And therefore, Yaakov has to struggle with who he is, and Yaakov takes all of the bounty that he has and finds a way of elevating it, which means what is the victory or what is the kryptonite to Saroshel Esav? The answer is it's Kedusha, it's holiness. Once Yaakov finds a way of taking his stuff and turning it to something which is holy, at that point Yaakov is victorious, which means that's exactly how you win, and it's really what Esav wasn't willing to go to. Esav was willing to own all kinds of things as long as there's no holiness. And the resolution of giving this bribe to Esav, the Ramban, it's not in this week's parsha, the Ramban in Vayikra, when he talks about Yom HaKippurim, based on the Pirkei Rabbi Lezer, says essentially the Seir La'azazel, Esav is Seir, the Seir La'azazel is the bribe which is being given over. And of course, just to make everything else perfect, the Zohar tells us that the moment that Yaakov and Esav parted ways was the time of Ne'ilah. The day that they met was Yom Kippur. The night before, when Yaakov wrestles with himself or wrestles with this angel, it's of course Kol Nidre. So of course we all struggle with who we are in Yom Kippur, I hope. We all ask ourselves, who are we? How did we get here? How did we become this person? And then we end up finding a resolution of wanting to bring more holiness in our lives. And basically the things that are unimportant to us, we throw away and we throw it to Esav. We give Esav a bribe and we say it to the Satan. We say to the Seer Lazazel. We say, leave us alone, Lazazel. Leave us alone. We don't really need any of this. And somehow this resolution takes place. Of course, how does the Zohar know that Yaakov just now, that this all takes place in Yom Kippur? Because where does Yaakov go immediately afterwards? He goes to Sukkot. So you go to Sukkot after Yom Kippur. So it's all very, very obvious. So let me now come back and get to everything else that I wanted to try to get to. There's actually two more episodes which I think are significant, or two other times that the leg is introduced in various ways, which are part of this story. So in case you weren't trying to figure out, so what is it that I did this week? So basically I'm looking and thinking all leg usage, and it was very easy to find, at least most of them. The other one was pretty obvious to me. It was source number 8. Vayomer Hashem Elokim el ha-nachash. And the nachash is a very interesting, because once we're talking about adversaries, so why are we only talking about adversaries in terms of Esav? But it really is all the same. It's Esav, it's the Satan, it's the Malach HaMavet, it's the Nachash. And the Nachash is scary because the Nachash has a great deal of capability. Those of you who don't know, the Nachash in Gematria is actually Mashiach. That should be the scariest Gematria you've ever heard. Is that there is this incredible amount of capability over there, but the capability is devoid of any Kedusha. That's exactly the point. When you have all of this capability and no Kedusha, so then something terrible is going to emerge. So what happens with the Nachash? Vayomer Hashem Elokim el ha-nachash, ki asita zot arurata mikol ha-beimah mikol chayat ha-sadeh, al gechoncha telech, va'afar tochal. You're going to crawl on your stomach and you're going to eat dust. Kol yimei chayecha, all the days of your life. Don't forget Rashi in source number 9, because maybe now you'll first realize why this is really important. What does Rashi say? You're going to crawl on your stomach. That means that he used to not crawl on his stomach. Raglayim hayulo v'niktatzitzu. He once had legs, and the legs were cut off. So this issue of legs being hurt and legs being wounded within the whole Yaakov-Esav relationship may very well have an earlier source to it than we've ever realized. And as I say it again, it goes right back to this Nachash. The other continuation, though, in Pasuk Tedvav, Ve'eva ashit bincha uvena isha, uven zar'acha, uven zar'a, hu yoshpacha rosh, he's going to smack you on the head, Vatat tishpatenu akav, and you're going to snipe or you're going to try to attack his feet. So, his feet. So, you don't have to be the Zohar to realize what I'm about to tell you, that whose feet get attacked? Well, Yaakov's feet get attacked. So if Yaakov's feet is getting attacked by some unknown adversary, so you just now found out who this adversary is, right? You just figured out who the adversary is. This is sort of like a song by the Rolling Stones, by the way. Oh, you know which one? Am I right? Okay. Sympathy for the devil. Do you know my name? Right? It keeps coming up. He's coming back in every scene in every generation, but he comes wearing different uniforms, but it's always the same task. And this attack against the leg, the Zohar, of course, is going to tell us. Oh, so this is part of this whole Yaakov Esav reality.
So who's the adversary?
The adversary here is the Nachash. But I'm saying is that later on, the Nachash is the Satan. And the Satan is the one who ends up being associated with the Saroshel Esav, with this power of Esav. So, just to take things the other way for a moment, source number 10, which is written in the Gemara, it's also a Zohar, if you need to know. It says, Shufrid Yaakov Avinu me'in Shufrid Adam Arishon. Yaakov's beauty, as it were, the way Yaakov looked was very similar or the same as Adam Harishon. Of course, the only thing you should wonder right now is that Adam Harishon before the sin or Adam Harishon after the sin. That and it's talking about the beauty of Adam Harishon. That becomes a very, very interesting statement. I'll explain more because there's a certain success. Okay, let me go back. Yaakov took the blessing, and now Yaakov became involved in a purely working environment, which means Yaakov, who was once the man who sat in tents, now he's in the field all the time for 20 years and making a living, and there seems to be this more of an Esav identity. There's something else that Yaakov did wrong that makes him vulnerable spiritually to this attack, and that I'll try to come back to. In source 11, you now see things which should be obvious. We're not going to read all of it. V'ishtereker Yaakov akev, the Yaakov dukina da adam kadma hava. Yaakov looked just, he had the same vision, he looked just like Adam. Kamad ukmul shufr de Yaakov gain shufr de Adam arishon. And he quotes the verse there, hu yishbech ha-rosh v'atatushpenu akev, da hava yadinun da hava atida lalkol michiv, that they knew that in the future what would happen, and we're going to skip a little bit over here, to the third line from the bottom of that source, va'ata tishu penu akev, vida, that is kaf yerech Yaakov. That is the same thing as Yaakov being attacked. So saying that the serpent is going to be attacking somebody's leg, he says, oh, that's actually what happened with Yaakov. That's where it plays itself out. A similar thing is found in source number 12, which is in the Zohar. And there's much more in the Zohar and Daf Lamed Hey that I'm bringing here. This is just a small part of it. But over here, it tells you in the beginning, Tanina b'hi sha'ata nachat Samael min Shemaya v'rachiv al nachash. The angel of Esav rode on the nachash. We're going to skip most of this. You can feel free to read it later. And Yaakov ended up two lines in the bottom. Yaakov unatal minei brachan de lo yitbarech sama el la'elav Esav latata. Yaakov ended up taking away the whatever power Esav had above and whatever power Yaakov had below. That Yaakov now is the person who's meaning. The Zohar over here is recognizing that Esav somehow is a manifestation of things which are evil, but the power comes from this Saroshel Esav, and Yaakov takes on both of them. Yaakov takes on Esav, and Yaakov takes on Saroshel Esav. And again, those of you who are really troubled that I just got too Kabbalistic, I don't apologize, but just realize that's what's going on in this parasha. Yaakov is wrestling with Saroshel Esav. What does that mean? Yaakov is wrestling. I'm saying all the Mefarshim say that. That's this mysterious person he's wrestling with. Yaakov is wrestling or struggling with Esav, and that comes out a little bit different. That's what the Zohar is talking about over here. And it ends up saying that Yaakov takes these blessings, and it ends up, Aba'alda v'yavak ishimo. And that's what it's talking about, that Yaakov struggled with him. Okay. Source number 13, Tzur Hamor, Rabbi Avraham Saba. He was an early mystic. He writes about the serpent. He's going to write, V'hu yishapenu rosh, right, you smack him on the head. B'kan remez inyan nachash akadmoni hu samael, shabab b'riyata isha. That he makes his first appearance at the same time that we find Eve being created. V'hu samael hu esav hu edom hu rosh asher yishtachavu sham. He is Esav. He is, again, just wondering the identity. He's saying this quite clear, skipping a little bit. And the first one came out all red. Hu ofen markavotav she'olem misparo kal, kiminyan samael. Now, I'm not going to explain everything here, but he says that the numerical value is related to 130, which is the numerical value of samael, which, of course, doesn't work because that's 131. So you can decide if you want to allow that extra number or not. He goes in and says that this is the source of all the curses in the world, and all the curses come from this first nachash, and this nachash attacks the leg, and that's why Yaakov's leg is hurt, as I will explain again in Parshat Vayishlach, and that's what the Tzur Hamor says. In Parshat Vayishlach, he says, although I do want you to note along the line over here that this is Rosh. What does Rosh have to do? Well, because his head is attacked. But what's Rosh? So there's really so much to say here, and we're just not going to be able to say everything. Reshit Goyim Amalek. Amalek is the first. Amalek is the first one being born is Esav, which is actually what he's talking about over here. The first one who seduces man to sin is the Nachash. And all of these things are interrelated. And let's read in source 14. He says that when the powers of Esav want to attack Yaakov, it attacks his Yerech. Now, let's just pause for a moment and think about Yerech. We've heard the phrase before, Simna yadcha tachat Yerechi. Who said that?
Avram
said that. And when did he say it? He says it to Eliezer when he wants him to Eved Avram, Eliezer, when he wants him to go and find a wife for Yitzchak. All of that is going to be connected to this, even though he doesn't spell it out for us. What does Rashi say he actually told him to do? He says that somehow put his hand near his circumcision because that's where the holiness was, that's where the covenant was, and that's what this is symbolic of. Over here, he says that Yaakov's vulnerability was actually the fact that he broke a Torah law, which of course you can defend him if you wish because it's before Matan Torah. So what do you mean you broke a Torah law? But if later on this is going to become a Torah law, so that means there must be some kind of spiritual problem with it. And he says, Shalom matzabo avon asher chata. There was no sins that Yaakov was guilty of. Mivad ki lefish lemuto v'tzidkato lo hi ra'ui lisa shtei achayot. It wasn't appropriate for Yaakov to marry two sisters. Of course, he had no choice about this. Of course, unless you want to say he did have a choice. The Yerech of Yaakov is hurt, which it's telling us over here is somehow connected to what we should understand as being some type of a sexual sin by marrying two women who he should not have married because they were both sisters. So it says that's the only spiritual vulnerability. And even the way that he phrased it was interesting because he didn't want to say that before Matan Torah was objectively wrong, but rather somebody as spiritual as Yaakov should have been able to avoid this in some way, shape, or form. So let's be very careful now as we get to source 15. Source 15 is the Magale Amukot. The Magale Amukot was a Rav Shapira. He was in Poland, Krakow. He was one of the great Kabbalists in Poland. And he writes as follows. Ratsa lehasig 72 agulim sheyesh l'shem shel havaya. ולכל עיגול גימל תגין, ומסעוד זה היו למטה סנהדרין גדולה וקטנה, ונקרו עיני העדה. I'm ignoring all of the gematriot so far, and all that he told you is that there is a greater and a lesser Sanhedrin. Markava למעלה בסעוד מגן, צדי גימל כלים היו במקדש, וסעוד הנחה יפה. There, and again, everything he's been saying here has to do with gematria. There were 93 vessels in the temple. When I gave this year and wrote an article about the 93 Beit Yaakov girls, there's no question in my mind that that was a literary invention based upon the 93 kelim in the Beit HaMikdash. I believe that I've proven that. And then he continues and he says, V'sod kishira Shmuel Hanavi David im yifei enayim. And this has to do with the secret when David saw Shmuel. Now, do any of us, so far he's mentioned Sanhedrin, and so far he's mentioned David, and he's mentioned David's beautiful eyes. And if those of you have no idea of anything I'm talking about, when David was seen by Shmuel, and Shmuel is going to become very important in all of this, he looks at him and he sees, oh my God, this can't be the right guy. He's a redhead. No offense to anybody who's a redhead or was once a redhead. Because he says, this reminds me of Esav. How can this be our leader? Which is very interesting. They were kings of Esav before they were kings of Israel. And now we're getting to the king of Israel who's going to be the king forever. And in this king, he looks at him, he's Esav. There's a power there, it's a similar power. But according to the Midrash, there's a difference, the Gemara as well, there's a difference. And that is that this person has sweet eyes, he has kind eyes. Which means you look at the red, and the red is a symbol of blood, but then you look, but he has sweet eyes. But what are the eyes? He's saying the Einayim are the Einayim of the, is the Sanhedrin. Because the Sanhedrin are called the Einei Ha'edah, the eyes of the community. So therefore, the difference between Yaakov and Esav is that Esav is lawless and Yaakov follows halacha. David follows halacha. David follows the Sanhedrin. David asks permission before he does things, except for the very sins that he does, which we will leave out. And then he said, Vesod, and we're skipping all of these words, Vesod mache imche. And this is the secret of wiping out Amalek. So, mache emche zecher Amalek. And Amalek has to be wiped out. V'sod kes ka. And this is the secret of God's throne, which is incomplete as long as Amalek is in the world. He then says, macha, the word macha, to wipe out. Nutrakin is like roshei tevot. Ma'adim chelbana Haman. Ma'adim, of course, is Mars, the red planet, the symbol above of blood, of spilling blood of Esav. Chelbana is the thing which is in the Ketoret, which has a terrible smell. And Haman. Shekulam olin tzadihei. Each one of these things equals 95. Ma'adim, Chelbana, and Haman. And this is very interesting, because Mache Amalek, the Chelbana, just for example, the Chelbana is terrible, but what happens when you take that terrible smell, that power, and you stick it within the Ketoret? You ended up having Kedusha. Which means there is this potential for Kedusha, but of course if you're Esav and you run away from Kedusha, it becomes very, very difficult. V'sod gadol b'gemara gamkein, l'chvosh malka iti b'bayit. And that's actually the secret behind capturing the queen in my house, which of course is talking about Esther. But what is the gematria of Malka? 40 and 30 is 70, and 20 is 90, and 5 is 95 again. So the Malka, which sometimes is the Shechina, which can be captured, is also 95. So 95 is Haman, and 95 is Ma'adim, and 95 is Chelbana. And we need now a little bit more explanation, and we could then have a chance to explain this. And he then goes on to say, and it's the 95 times that Allah is like Rabbi Yossi, and he says, and we'll skip a little bit more, V'sod, we don't want to get to Lilit. And then he writes, and it's also the Sod of the Kol Yaakov, because the Kol Yaakov is written the first time, V'sod HaKol Kol Yaakov, Kol Rishon Chaser. The first time it says Kol Kol Yaakov, but Daniel Esav, it says Kol Chaser, and Kol Chaser is Kol Flamed, which is 130, which is also Samael, which is also almost Besod Im Pagambo Minuval Zemashchei LeBeit HaMidrash V'Zesod Sulam. Sulam Yaakov is also 130 Zes Sinai, which is also, and that's a midrash. It's Sulam and Sinai all the same. Sarech Latakin Samael Mispar Salam Im Sinai. So those of you who've lost everything that I just now said, so. The Sulam is Sinai. That's the Midrash. This is one of the gematriot which are in Midrash Rabbah. It says the Sulam and Sinai, because that's how you connect to heaven. Following what we heard at Sinai is how you connect to heaven. The Sulam is Sinai. But what else did it say is 130? It also says that that's what Samael is. Because what does the Yetzirah do? What does the Nachash do? that we're told specific things to do, and it tells us not to do it. Which means the power over here, the Yetzer Hara versus the Yetzer Tov, the Yetzer Hara becomes the Sulam. Sorry, the Yetzer Tov is the Sulam. The Yetzer Tov is Sinai. There we're told what we need to do. And the opposite power of this is the Nachash, and is Esav, and is the Sarosha Esav, and so on and so forth. And as I said, over here it's all connected again with two different numbers they were playing with. One was the Malkah was captured. You know, if you're talking about the Malkah is captured, that's 95, and that's Haman, and that's Emimche. We have to get rid of this. We need to bring the Malkah back. Now, let's just try to put all this together, because we, of course, will run out of time. The Sulam is the source of holiness. In source 16 is the verses about the Sulam. Of course, what's troubling there is it says, Malchei Elohim olim v'yordimbo. It says that they went up and then they came down, and any of us who don't know what the verse says, we always imagine it said the opposite, that angels live there and they come down and they go back up. But no, they start here and they go up. There's a beautiful midrash in Surah 16 that tells us why this is. The only question is if I want to do this yet. Maybe we'll save this a little bit. And first we'll explain about the Malkah. Who is the first Malkah who ever lived? Chava. She, in a sense, is queen of the world. What happened to Chava? Chava got captured. How did she get captured? By the Nachash, by the Sarosha Esav. What is there the resolution? Well, the resolution was, as far as the Nachash goes, he loses his legs, which I hope you now realize this is connected to all this. And what happens afterwards also? What happens to her? Well, then the hitting on the head and the legs and so on. And what happens to her? She's going to have difficult pregnancies, and she'll have this connection to her husband, right? So who was the first woman who had a really difficult pregnancy? Rivka. Difficult pregnancy? Sarah's pregnancy was a laugh. Difficult pregnancy was Rivka. To the point, what is going on? Why am I alive? What's happening? That should tell you something. That should tell you that somehow Rivka is directly connected to Chava. She actually has two kids, and that's exactly the issue. One of them is there as a tikkun for Adam. And that's Yaakov, is a tikkun for Adam. And the other one somehow reminds us of the Nachash and reminds us of the sin and reminds us of all of this negativity and blood spitting and all death in the world. All death in the world is related to the Nachash. So there is something going on over here within Rivka's pregnancy. Rivka herself, when she comes in, we're told she comes riding in on a camel. The only reason why that's really interesting is that's the way the Satan is described, as riding in on a camel. And she comes riding on a camel in order to do, her whole life over here is going to do a tikkun of really, Yaakov is going to end up doing a tikkun. And I'll remind you something, the Nachash brings death into the world, and Esav looks like death, he's full of red, and Yaakov Avinu lomet. Yaakov Avinu is somebody, and of course, which aspect of Yaakov doesn't die? That's Yisrael. The aspect of Yaakov that never dies is that of Yisrael, because Am Yisrael chai v'kayam, netzach Yisrael lo yishaker. We will last on forever, and let me try to just explain one or two more things, and then hopefully this will be able. It says it in the Zohar. So, let me try one or two more things. In source number 22, this is the Arizal. Uvize yuvan in yan chana imo, which is interesting because he just now came back to Shmuel. Shmuel Hanavi. Who's Shmuel Hanavi? Shmuel Hanavi is the one who pours the oil on, well, actually poured the oil on two people. He's the one who anoints Shaul, and he's the one who anoints David. And right? He's explaining according to the Saba de Mishpatim. If you don't know who the Saba Mishpatim is, it is in the Zohar, in Parshat Mishpatim, there's an old man who explains some secrets. So that's what he's revealing here. Ki kishatiken Shmuel HaNetzach, Shmuel Hanavi fixed Netzach. So again, one more time, we're going to go back to a Kabbalistic image. We have Avram and Yitzchak, right? And then we have Yaakov in the middle. Chesed, Gevura, Tiferet, and then Netzach and Hod. Netzach and Hod represent the two legs. Right? You have the arms, you have the body, then you have the legs. Netzach and Hod are the two legs. It's the leg which is hurt. That's exactly the problem. So he's saying over here, in Shmuel Hanavi is the one who fixes the Netzach, right? Nitan sod hayerech ala nachash. And that is the secret of the yerech that was hurt by the nachash, which again goes back to the yerech having to do with Yaakov and having to do with the nachash. Be'inyan yerech hasota kenoda, and this is connected to the leg of the sota, as is well known. So, why do I have a suspicion this was not well known before we started today? So, let's make this well known. Kinitan yerecha shel sota l'sama el t'marat yerech Yaakov, that there was some kind of a trade that went on over here, but I'm not going to say much more, rather than look at source 23 is the whole parshat sota, and there should be a couple words that you should recognize from everything else that we've seen today. Ufara et rosh, the beginning, the rosh, the head is uncovered. The head being uncovered has to do with Reshit Goyim Amalek, it has to do with the first one who attacked, and that's the Nachash, and that's the power of the Eitz Sahara, and that's the Nachash who seduces Chava. And then what is offered? Minchat Knaot, a mincha of jealousy. The word mincha kept coming up in that whole section with Yaakov. And what then happens? She, satit tachat ishech, she was somebody who refused to take the tikkun that took place in Gan Eden, that there would be a connection with her husband, and she cheats on her husband. And what happens then when she drinks the water? B'teit Hashem et yirchech nofelet, her thigh will fall. And over here you have the Yerech again, which means basically, in the narrative of the Torah, other than getting to Korbanot, you have the Yerech dealing with people only by Yaakov and over here by the Sota. So obviously the Arizal is going to tell us that this is connected. The Shlah HaKadosh in 24 says, V'yachokuk b'Yerech shelo nachash, that I think the way to understand this is that Esav had a tattoo of a nachash on his thigh. Which is, again, you could take that as literally as you want, but it's saying that's exactly the point, because of the Samael, Saro, Shalaisav, and Tuma. And then just go a little bit further. When Yaakov bows down, what happens when you bow down? You're not using either one of your legs. You become like the Nachash, whose legs were cut off. Yaakov bowing down to Esav is, in a sense, is losing his legs, and that's something which is considered to be terribly wrong. Of course, notice that the letters of the word Berech are the same as Bracha and the same as Bechor, and is connected to that whole idea of the blessings and the firstborn. And it says, V'hatum'an, third line in Source 24, the Shlach Kadosh, V'hatum'an nag'a b'yerech ha-shvatim asher karu, that it was Tum'ah, how do we translate Tum'ah? Impurity. It affects the Shvatim when they bow down to Esav. Because that's another power, that's not God. And then he writes, Ki David u'mashiach tikun Adam besod Adam, Adam David u'mashiach. V'az yichzar Karen or panav. David, of course, was anointed with a Karen. He was anointed with the oil. And David HaMelech is Melech forever, and that's Netzach, and that's Malchut, and that's really where Malchut Israel comes from. I know that I'm not explaining anything properly today, but just towards the end, Kilo noladit adayin be'etcha karula Esav. Binyamin is where the first... Okay, 1 second. I skipped a couple of lines that I wanted. Ki Yerech Binyamin lo karala Esav. But the Yerech of Binyamin was never hurt, because he didn't bow down. V'zeu sod pachim k'tanim. And that, because he's the youngest one, so therefore he could be... He wasn't born yet. So he never bowed down, so his legs were never lost, and therefore he will have power, and therefore that's the pachim k'tanim that were poured over the youngest one, over Binyamin, which of course Shaul HaMelech comes from Binyamin. V'zeu sod nishar l'pachim k'tanim, right, and so on. Zeu Shaul v'ishboshet v'nimshach b'pach, v'davud u'shlomo nimshachu b'keren, and therefore it ends up being Vayeren Karen Mishicho. So I want to get to one more thing, and then I really will try to make sense out of most of this. In source number 17, we're back to the Sulam, which was the last thing that I wanted to try to put together, and then I'll hopefully try to make sense. The Midrash over here says that the angels were down, and they looked at Yaakov sleeping, and they climbed the ladder. So it's really interesting. We were just told that Esav has a tattoo, as it were, of the Nachash, and the angels look at Yaakov and they see that Yaakov's image is engraved on the Kisei HaKavod. And they climb up and they see Yaakov's face on the Kisei HaKavod. And they come down and they see him. Which means they look at Yaakov and they say, we've seen this face before. They climb up, they look at the Kisei HaKavod, and then they come back down. So they look and they say, this is who Yaakov is. So the angels see the Kedusha within Yaakov. In source number 19, Rashi raises a question. Is this it? Yes, Rashi raises a question. What in the world happened to those 400 soldiers? Remember we started with them? So it says, Esav Levado, right? V'yoshev b'yamahu Esav Darko. Esav Levado by himself. V'barma ot isha cholimu nimshatu me'etzlo echad echad. They all disappeared one after the other. They sort of left. And it's interesting because, I'm going to skip the rest of Rashi. And I want you to see in the next source, in 20. No, sorry. Not 20, source 18, because this is where Rashi took it from. V'yashav b'yomuhu esav l'darko se'ira, v'amu ish shayoi moheichan heim, nishmatu kol achad v'chad halach l'darko, and here are the words Rashi left out, amru shalo nikve b'gal chato shel Yaakov. We don't want to get burnt by Yaakov. Emet ha'parad l'makadosh baruch l'halan, v'lo n'tarmi ish ki im arbamot ish nara sherech vol gamalim, v'yinasu. And those of the during the time of David, there were 400 men, which... You obviously understand that this is the continuation because there's 400 men in Gamalim and David HaMelech, but what happened to the 400 thugs that we started with? The 400 thugs, these are people who know how to fight. These are people who know how to fight any enemy. The problem is there's one person they don't know how to fight. They don't know how to fight somebody who's full of Kedusha. And suddenly they look at him and they see this person who's totally full of Kedusha. How do you fight somebody full of Kedusha? How does Yaakov fight with an angel? Where do you hit an angel? You pull off his wings, like the feathers? You take a look? What do you do to an angel? How do you fight an angel? Which means that Yaakov is somebody who struggles with this world and he struggles with holiness. It's interesting that these two midrashim, the angels look at Yaakov and they realize Yaakov's connected to heaven. At this moment, the 400 men see the exact same thing. Yaakov's connected to heaven. We can't fight with him. This whole thing having to do with the legs has to do with who Yaakov is and the establishment of Yaakov, the establishment of the land of Israel, the establishment of Kedusha. It is a very difficult struggle that Yaakov has because Yaakov is not just somebody who's going to be sitting in the tents. Yaakov is going to be part of this real world. But this real world needs to become a real world of Kedusha, a real world of holiness. That's the struggle that Yaakov has. Yaakov succeeds in doing this. Esav represents death, and Esav represents the Nachash, and Esav represents red, and so on. But Yaakov prepares the way for David. You know, it's really going back to our Kabbalistic image one more time. The center is Yaakov, and then Yosef, and then David. Shmuel is the one who fixes the Nevuah, which is the two legs have to do with Nevuah, the Netzach and the Hod, and Shmuel fixes this. And then we're ready for the next level. Then we're ready for Malchut. Then we're ready for Malchut Beit David to come. Which means the Malchut of Esav, which emerges in this week's parasha, is a very simple Malchut. There's no holiness to it. It's pure brute strength. Yaakov, on the other hand, has so much more of a complicated life. And it's complicated in real life. And isn't it wonderful that I made it so much more complicated today? All that I try to point out is that Yaakov's life goes all the way back to Adam HaRishon and go all the way back to Melech HaMashiach. That's where Yaakov is in the middle. Yaakov is this connection of the past and the future. That's what it means to be in the middle. That's what it means to be in this, what's called Kav HaRachamim, in the center. Yaakov is this connection between what's above and what's below. Yaakov's reality, okay, now you realize Rivka's pregnancy is so much more complicated. Rivka's pregnancy is one which is really the pregnancy that God spoke about in terms of Chava. That's the pain, the difficult pregnancy. The leg being attacked goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. That's exactly the Nachash and the attack on the leg. Yaakov, from the very beginning in utero, it's the leg between him and Esav. And now again, Yaakov over here and Saroshel Esav, which is great. It's as if to say that in terms of Esav himself, Yaakov doesn't really have to deal with, because Yaakov can defeat the Saroshel Esav. Esav may not understand this at all, but the 400 thugs that he have, they take one look at Yaakov, and they have the same reaction that the angels had when they looked at Yaakov. We want no part of this. We can't fight this. We don't know how to fight such a thing. And I'll say it again. Anti-Semites understand Kedusha. Anti-Semites look at holiness and it drives them crazy. But ultimately look at holiness, and if they really understand it, then they simply run away. At the end of the day, Esav sees Yaakov, and he does the same. He bows, not literally, but he recognizes the land of Israel is Yaakov's, and he walks away, and he goes to Seir, and he leaves the land of Israel for Yaakov. The descendants of Esav and the descendants of Yishmael don't always remember this. They know that we have the Kedusha. We know that the holiness is here. They know that we, connected to the land, is this whole other power of holiness, which drives them completely crazy. But they too will bow and walk away and leave Yaakov what belongs to him, because of all of the poison of the Nachash and all the poison of the devil and the Malach HaMavet, Yaakov Avinu lo met.